Oh, God bless you. Without you, I'd be back yonder.
Tut, tut, says I. Not a bit of it. Without you, we'd be in Queer Street, instead of jingling with cash. Have some more champagne. She didn't answer for a moment. Then she says, in a very low voice,
You kept your word. No white man ever did that to me before. No white man ever helped me before.
Ah, well, says I, you haven't met the right chaps, that's all. She was overlooking, of course, that I hadn't any choice in the matter, but I wasn't complaining. She was grateful, which was first rate, and must be promptly taken advantage of. If there is one thing that can make me randier than usual, it is danger safely past. And Cassie said later that she'd never willingly made love to a man before, and I believed her. The upshot was that Mr. and Mrs. Montague spent that night and the rest of next day in passionate indulgence, never bothering about the world outside. It was late on the next afternoon before I tumbled out to dress myself and take a turn on the promenade. Cassie wouldn't come out, though. She decided that the less she was seen, the better, until we were up among the free states, which was sensible. Well, thinks I, you've had some bad luck, my boy, but surely it's behind you now. Presently, I went back to the stateroom and ordered up a dinner, the first full meal we had sat down to in style, and the first Cassie had had since she was a little girl, she told me. Although we were alone in the cabin, she insisted on putting on the finest dress I'd bought her, a very pale, coffee-coloured satin, and those golden shoulders coming out of it and that strange Egyptian head of hers with its slanting eyes quite kept me off my food. That night, she tasted port for the first time in her life. I recall her sipping it and setting down the glass and saying, This is how the rich live, is it not? Then I am going to be rich. What use is freedom to the poor?
Well, thinks I, it doesn't take long to get ambition. Yesterday all you wanted was to be free. However, our blissful little idyll was coming to an end.
Evening saw us at Cincinnati, but Cassie was in a fever of anxiety for the boat to move off again. Cincinnati was a great place for slave catchers, and she cried with relief when at last we churned on upriver. But at breakfast time next day, there was a rude awakening. The weather had grown colder and colder throughout our journey, and now, when you looked overside, there were great cakes of dirty brown and green ice riding down the current, and a powdering of snow lying on the Ohio bank. The fellows in the saloon were of opinion that the boat would go no farther than Portsmouth in this kind of weather. Cassie, I saw, was trembling.
We are not safe, says she. The Ohio River is the boundary between the slave states and the free. If we land on the Indiana or Ohio shores, I could still be retaken by the slave catchers who are thick along the river.
But surely they can't take you off free state soil.
Of course they can. There are laws forbidding people in Ohio to aid runaways. Slaves are caught and dragged back across the river daily by these bands of catchers with their guns and dogs, and notices of my running from Memphis would have been telegraphed to the Kentucky shore. My name would have been added to the list of the other poor hunted creatures trying to escape north.
And I had thought my bad luck was behind me. Of course, a moralist would say that my circumstance was to be expected. He would doubtless point out that I had fornicated my way almost continuously along the Mississippi Valley, and draw the conclusion that all my trials arose from this. I don't know about that. But sure enough, down comes the captain presently, all gravity and grey whiskers, to announce to the saloon that he couldn't make Portsmouth this trip on account of the ice, but would put in at Fisher's Landing, which was 3 miles short of the town, and set anyone ashore that wanted to go. The rest he would carry back to Cincinnati.